A warm welcome to St. Peter's Barge, London's only floating church. If you're here for the first time, a special welcome to you. And this is our book week, the week of the book. We're looking at the world's bestseller, the Bible. And the talk this evening is on Are the Gospels Reliable History? And we're delighted to welcome Peter Williams from Cambridge University. He's the warden of Tyndale House, and he's going to come up now. I'm going to ask him a few questions just so we can get to know him. So welcome. Welcome to the barge.
Thank you.
So, Peter, you're the warden of Tyndale House, and there are probably all the terms in that description will be foreign to most people. So, firstly, Tyndale House and then warden thereof. What's that involve?
We'll start with William Tyndale, who first translated the Bible or the New Testament from Greek into English in 1526, age 32. That's the first English translation of the Bible from the Greek. So it's named after him, started in 1944, and it's now the best biblical studies library in Britain in terms of any books you want to find for the academic study of the Bible. But about 40, 50 people on there on a daily basis, and the warden is in charge of it. But I take the credit for what goes right and, you know, wash my hands if anything goes wrong.
And what's your background then? How did you get to be? You're actually the youngest warden of Tyndale House ever. Now, how does a person get to become warden of Tyndale House? What's your background?
Well, I studied languages as an undergraduate at Cambridge, Greek, Latin, Hebrew, and Aramaic, all ancient dead things because no one criticizes your accent. So I did that, and sort of it led naturally on to studying the Bible and teaching it.
And, I mean, I've done a little search on you on Google's a wonderful thing, isn't it? But it says that you are a language expert. So do you want to tell us a bit more?
Well, your English is very good as well. So obviously everyone's got expertise in language, but I do tend to deal with dead languages, again, because no one criticises my accent.
So you speak them as well as read and write?
No, but I read the Bible and study ancient manuscripts and how the Bible was translated a long, long time ago.
And you started your studies in Old Testament, is that right?
That's right, yeah.
And then you moved to New Testament.
Yeah, they're not very long. I mean, the Old Testament takes about 40 hours to read, maybe 45, and the New Testament maybe 20. So, I mean, out loud, you know.
It's not. But to switch disciplines like that is fairly unusual, is that fair to say?
Unfortunately, nowadays people have become very specialised.
Yes, yes. I mean, I found a quote from was it? Don Carson said, "Not many scholars can speak competently across as many technical fields as Pete can." How about that, Don Carson? If Don Carson's a name that means anything to you. So we're very, we're honoured that you're here today and to have such an expert in our midst. And the plan is that Peter's going to speak for 30 to 40 minutes on this topic, and then there's a chance for questions from the floor. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much. It's great to be here. First time I've ever spoken on a boat. So hopefully it will be a cruise next time, though. But it's really nice to be here. What we're going to look at tonight is, are the four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, which you can find in the Bible. Just search Bible on the internet and you'll find Bible. But you can also buy them in hard copy as well. Those four texts, which maybe would take 10 hours to read together, are they historically reliable? And so on. Now, you might think, why should I trust what Christians say about the origins of Christianity? After all, they are biased. And that would be a reasonable thing. Being biased doesn't mean what you say is wrong. If someone accuses you of doing something, the fact that you're biased in favour of your innocence doesn't mean you're not. No, you feel passionately about things. And of course, the early Christians felt passionately about Christianity. For most of what we need to know about early Christianity, we need to go to Christian sources. Just as most things written about football are by football fans, it's the same about the beginnings of Christianity. But what I want to do is to begin with some accounts by non-Christians. I've got a screen up there. You don't need to look at it that much, but if you do want to follow along there, you can. Everything, the most important things are going to be on the handout. So we're going to look firstly at some non-Christian accounts of the beginnings of Christianity. Then we're going to look at some of the things we can find within the four Gospels and then make some conclusions together. So let's start with some non-Christian evidence. The second page of your handout, there's something called Tacitus Annals, a little quotation here. This is a man who was born around the year 56. I'm told that people generally in this area of London are very good at numbers, so we've got lots of numbers tonight. Okay. Born around the year 56, and when he was around age 8, AD 64, there's a big fire in Rome. And people thought Nero the emperor had started it, which obviously made him less popular. And so Nero looked for other people to blame, and so he blamed the Christians. And Tacitus writes about this. Well, you might think, what does an 8-year-old know? But when people look at Tacitus's own writings for things that happened 50 years before he is born, they find them very trustworthy. But this is actually not just 50 years before he's born, it's actually in the town where he lives. And what he says is this: but neither by help by humans nor generous gifts from the emperor, the bribes, nor all the ways placating heaven could stifle the scandal or dispel the belief that the fire had taken place by order of Nero. Therefore, to scotch the rumour, Nero substituted as culprits and punished with the utmost refinements of cruelty a class of men loath for their vices whom the crowd styled Christians. Well, you've got that word Christian coming up. Comes, of course, from the Latin word Christus, Christ. Christus, the founder of the name, had undergone the death penalty in the reign of Tiberius by the sentence of the procurator Pontius Pilatus or Pontius Pilate, and the pernicious superstition was checked for a moment, not only to break out once more, not merely in Judea, the home of the disease, so he didn't really like Christianity, but in the capital, that's Rome itself, where all things horrible or shameful in the world collect and find vogue. I hope you like your capital more than he did. First, then, the confessed members of the sect were arrested. Next, on their disclosures, vast numbers were convicted, not so much on account of arson as for hatred of the human race. So Christians back then, human haters. Some people even say it now. And derision accompanied their end. They were covered with wild beast skins and torn to death by dogs, or they were fastened on crosses, and when daylight failed, were burned to serve as lamps by night. Hence, in spite of a guilt which had earned the most exemplary punishment, there arose a sentiment of pity due to the impression that they were being sacrifices not for the welfare of the state, but to the ferocity of a single man. Now, I wanted to read that all out so you get a sense of this writer. He's no friend at all of Christianity, but he does manage to confirm some important things about Christianity. Firstly, the founder of the name is called Christ. And in agreement with the four Gospels, he says that he was condemned under Pontius Pilate. Now, Pontius Pilate, we know from other sources, was governor of Judea from the year 26 to 36. So, in fact, we managed to get some date for the origins of Christianity out of this material. We can also say that he confirms how difficult it was being a Christian back then, that there's a lot of persecution. And he confirms that Christianity began in Judea and spread to Rome in about 30 or so years. And in those 30 years, had grown so that there were vast numbers of Christians in Rome. Now, the distance from Jerusalem to Rome, as the crow flies, which a crow probably wouldn't do there, is the same as the distance from Rome up to the top of the Shetland Islands, just to give you a sense of how fast Christianity spread in that context, of course, when they didn't have such rapid travel or communication or means of networking. But that's what happened. And I think that's a significant thing, because some people suggest that Christianity was sort of made up all a lot later, that the stories were recounted half a century later, and that's when all the innovation took place. The problem with that view is that Christianity has spread so far and so fast, it actually becomes very hard to start changing it after that point. Also, because Christians even become, by their own account, divided from each other. So you'd have to, in fact, go and persuade every single group if you wanted to introduce an innovation. So think, if you're starting a marketing campaign, you get the message right first before it all spreads out. Because once it spreads out, it's very difficult to start changing the message. So one of the things that he says is there were large numbers of Christians, and Christianity spread far and fast. That's our first non-Christian witness. Let's take another one. Now, this chap is a little bit later, Pliny is governor of northwest Turkey, a place called Bithynia, around the year 112. And he is writing in a very creepy way to the emperor at the time, asking how he should deal with Christians. And this is what he says. Of course, he wants to say how well he's already dealing with Christians. He's just asking for a bit of extra affirmation and advice. He says, I interrogated these people at court as to whether they were Christians. If they confessed, I interrogated them a second and third time, threatening punishment. If they persisted, I ordered them to be led off, in other words, to execution. As for those who denied that they were or ever had been Christians, when they invoked the gods in words given by me and prayed with incense and wine offerings to your statue, which I had ordered to be brought for this very purpose, along with the images of the gods, and also cursed Christ, which it said that no true Christian could ever be compelled to do, I thought they should be discharged. Well, he's a decent chap, isn't he? Very nice. So he's got the lenient line. You just kill those who persist as Christians. If they renounce the faith, you let them off. Whereas another line might be, say, just kill them lot. Okay? You notice he's got a number of tests for whether someone's a real Christian. And basically he's trying to get them to deny the faith. One of the tests is to worship the emperor. Now, that's an interesting thing because it actually reveals something about Christian belief. Namely, that Christians only worship one being. We know, everyone seems to agree, that Christianity arose out of Judaism. Well, how many gods do Jews believe in? I knew I thought I'd test your numbers tonight. How many gods do Jews believe in? One. So the only way they can worship a being is by identifying that being as that god. And so he's got a number of tests, and they all are about worshipping another being. And of course, the Christians generally refuse to do that. In fact, it said he tried to get people to curse Christ, which it said that no true Christian can ever be compelled to do. I think it's a fascinating phrase that here, about 80 years after the beginnings of Christianity, someone is writing to the emperor, distinguishing between Christians and true Christians, if you like, Christians in name only and true Christians, which is always a really significant distinction. I think 70% of people in Britain would use the name Christian of themselves. But here we've got an interesting distinction in this source, which we can also find in the New Testament, between those who are real believers, have had their lives changed, thoroughly committed to Christ, and those who are not. Anyway, he goes on about a document that had listed some people as Christians. Others named in the document said that they were Christians, but later denied it, saying that they had been, but they'd ceased 3 years ago, or many years ago, or even as much as 20. They said that this had been the full extent of their guilt or error. They'd been accustomed to meet on a fixed day before dawn and to sing antiphonally, that's one side of the room to another, or one side of the congregation to another, a song to Christ as to a god, and to bind themselves by an oath not to some crime, but rather not to commit theft, robbery, or adultery, not to break their trust, and not to refuse to return a pledge when asked to do so. Many people of every age and every rank and of both sexes are being and will be called to trial. Nor is it only the cities that are affected, but the disease of this superstition. Again, similar words to the former writer, Tacitus. The disease of this superstition is also reaching villages and farmsteads. It seems possible to check and correct this. It's pretty well agreed that the temples, which had almost become deserted, have now begun to be frequented again. And all the sacred rites, which had been neglected for a long time, are recommencing. And the flesh for sacrificial rites is being sold, for which up to now it was hard to find a purchaser. Well, you can take that home and study it, but what I find so fascinating about this is he describes what went on in a Christian meeting, according to his informants, some of whom had stopped being Christians 3 years ago, or many years ago, or even as much as 20. Well, you know, 112 minus 20, we get to 92. We're back into a description of what went on in a church meeting in the first century, okay? Now, you know the Dan Brown story is that 300 years after Christianity began, a powerful emperor came along and said, let's make Jesus not just a mere human, let's make him into a god, right? Let's, you know, give him the upgrade. A more sophisticated view might say that gradually over time, Jesus went in people's eyes from being a very special human to a very, very special human to a very, 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 then halfway to God, three quarters of the way to God, and then finally all the way to God. Now, there's a problem with this. As I said, Christianity began amid Judaism. And Jews only have one God, which means you cannot have a half-God. The Greeks can do a Percy Jackson, you know, those films, where, you know, a god looks down from the sky, sees a beautiful girl, gets together with her, and what they produce is half-God. And then you've just added another half to the number of gods there are. Okay? It's an unbounded set. You can't do that in Judaism, which means that route, that gradually over time, you exalt someone to be halfway God, three quarters of the way to God, all the way to God, can't happen. That evolutionary process is simply blocked. And here we've got the very interesting thing, that in this meeting, as recorded by the governor of the area, writing to the emperor, they are worshipping Christ as a God. Now, there's no word a in Latin, the language he's writing in, so it doesn't distinguish between God or a God. But if Christianity began amid Judaism, and that's what even the word Christian comes from, it's the word Messiah, that Christ is the word Messiah from the Jewish vocabulary, it's a really striking thing, isn't it? And we've already seen that one of the things we knew about Christians is they're not going to worship anyone but the one true God. So the fact that they're treating Christ as the object of their singing and their praising, their songs, means it's at that stage, early on, that they think that he really is the God who's made the universe. But there's more. We know how difficult it is for these people, and we know just how many there were. There are so many people who have become Christians that it is affecting the economy. Temples are almost being deserted. The governor writing to the emperor saying, temples in my area almost deserted, and people not buying sacrificial meat. Well, I could find a bit of the New Testament that says something pretty similar. Acts chapter 19, it's not a book we're looking at, not one of the Gospels, it's one just after, which talks about the beginnings of Christianity. And guess what it says? Christianity spread far and fast, lots of them, and things changed so much that it started affecting the economy. People weren't buying idols anymore, and there were big riots and so on. And it also talks about how difficult it was to be a Christian. So what we see coming across, whether we read non-Christian sources or Christian sources, is the same pattern. And I suggest that's a difficult pattern in which to make things up. I could also write about someone, talk about a quotation from this chap, Josephus, who's talking about how even members of Jesus' own family were prepared to die for the belief, but I'll move on. Let's then go on to some Christian testimony. Now, I want to introduce you to some things that have only really been known in the last 10 years about the Gospels. How do you know what something's like? Well, I'd heard about St. Peter's Barge, for a few years before coming here, but until I came here, I didn't know what it was like. I guess I could have maybe found a picture of the inside if I'd searched the web enough. But until I came here, I didn't really have an idea. You know, a boat that's a church. But the picture I had in my mind was actually different. The angle at which it was moored was different, and so on. When you're an eyewitness, then things change. You suddenly notice all sorts of things, okay? So I wouldn't know that the decoration inside the barge was so light, and so on. That sort of thing, you just don't know. Now, if you're going to make up a story, you've got a huge amount of effort if you're going to make it up as a historical fiction. In a piece of historical fiction, because you have to get details right in every area. So I've got a list up there of things that you would have to get right. It's on the handout as well at the top. If you're making up a story about Jesus and the Gospels, you've got to say, do you get the right plants for the time and place? Do you get the right coinage? Do you get the right shape of the land? When you mention travel distances, do you give the right amount of time to travel and so on? Now, of course, it would be easier for someone who lives in the land itself. But one of the striking things is that scholars from a wide range of views seem to think that, you know, three or maybe all four Gospels were not written in the land where Christianity originated. Okay? Three or four of the Gospels are not written in that land, which makes it even more impressive if you start getting some of these sorts of details right. But I don't think if you were making up a story living in the land, you would even manage to get all of these things right. So let's look at some of them. One of the most striking tests that's just come out in the last 8 years, is the test of personal names, what people were called. And some people did some studies, and they said, let's look at all the gravestones. Let's look at all the bone boxes. People would put people's bones into boxes and maybe put their name on. Let's look at all the historical records outside the New Testament and find out just what people were called, what the most common names were. And I've given you on the handout some of the statistics that you find there. Josephus, the historian of the time, has as his name number one the name Simon, the most popular name for a Jewish male from Palestine. Top name was Simon. That's also, by sheer coincidence, the top name amongst the four Gospels and the Book of Acts when they write about Palestinian Jewish males. His second most popular name is Joseph. That's also, by the way, the second most popular name amongst the four Gospels. Now, you read the four Gospels, and they're clearly by four different people. They've got different styles. But they agree on some of these sorts of things. So what we can say, and this is something you could find in a book called Jesus and the Eyewitnesses, which is by Professor Richard Borkham, who is Professor of New Testament up at St. Andrews University, is that based on about 3,000 different names, you really find the same sort of pattern showing up. So if we could look at it like this, the top two men's names in Palestine, about 15% of men had those names. Inside the New Testament is about 18%. Well, that's reasonably close. If I make the data sample bigger and I say, what about the top nine men's names in Palestine? I find about 41% of men have those names, and inside the New Testament, it's 40%. Now, you can look at the raw data and work out whether you think it's significant. I found one of the chaps who had the top performing pension fund last year told me he thought it was significant, which is always an encouraging thing. So you look at the ladies, and there are fewer examples of these names and much less imagination, I'm afraid. So the data sample's smaller and the numbers don't go so closely together, but still broadly in the same direction. The top two women's names in Palestine, 29%, outside the New Testament, about 39%. Inside, half of women called one of those top nine names outside the New Testament, about 61%. Inside the New Testament. So, again, we're finding a similar pattern. Now, this pattern, you could say, shows up roughly in the four different writers and in the writers together. It's a very interesting thing. Now, I don't know, I've got a son called Leo. Okay, anyone got any children called Leo? No. When I called my son Leo, I was calling him Leo because my grandfather's called Leo, but also because I'm Peter Williams, and I think there's lots of Peter Williamses around. At least I come across them. And so I thought, I'll give him a more unusual name. And I thought the name Leo was unusual. Until, of course, I call my son Leo. And then there are tons of Leos around, and there's two others in his class. And so people often have the experience that what they think is an unusual name, when they give it to a child, only straight afterwards to find out it's actually a very common name. Why is that? Because our intuitions as to what common names are not very reliable. So if you know what the most popular names are, it may be because you've read a magazine article that tells you. But back then, they didn't have any of that sort of data, any Office for National Statistics. That means someone outside the country, how's he going to know what to call people? If I tell you, I want you to make up a story about, let's say, Libya 50 years ago, can you give people the right name? Well, you might say, well, I know Muammar is a Libyan name, and, you know, al-Magrahi is a Libyan name, and you might have some vague idea of Arab names. But would you know how the names in Libya differ from other countries in North Africa or countries, Arab countries and so on? Would you have any reliable idea about that? I don't think you would. Of course, those names are going to differ from one place to another. And we find it's exactly the same with these sorts of things. So we can look at Palestinian Jewish men and we can find out what the most popular names are, but we could go down to Egypt, where there are lots of Jews as well, down in Alexandria, and you find that they have a different pattern of names. So the most popular name, Simon, is no longer popular in Alexandria. And then at 62nd in the ranking is Sabbatius. Now, does anyone know anyone called Sabbatius? Right. I've asked many people this question, and the answer is always no. Why is that? Because the Gospels weren't written about Jewish men in Egypt. Otherwise, it would probably be a common name. So you see, Dositheus and Pappus look to us like weird names, but lots and lots of Jews in Egypt had that name. So if you were just sitting on a French island or in Greece or Italy making up a story about what had happened with Jesus, I don't think you would give the characters the right names. I don't think you'd give the characters the right names if you just met someone travelling and said, tell me what people are called in that land I'm writing about. And I don't think you would even get the right pattern of names if you lived in the land itself, because your intuitions aren't that reliable as to produce things in the right proportion. But there's a little bit more. You see, what happens if Simon is such a popular name? Well, you call out Simon, and lots of people turn their head. So you have to do what Wikipedia calls disambiguation, okay? You distinguish one Simon from another Simon. You find, in fact, the Gospels doing this. With the most popular names, they add something extra. So Jesus has two disciples called Simon. One Simon Peter, or Cephas. The other Simon the Zealot, or Simon the Canaanite. You add something extra. Jesus has a meal with someone called Simon the Leper. Simon Peter goes to stay with Simon the Leatherworker, or the Tanner. Simon of Cyrene carries the cross. And the same thing happens with Mary. Mary Magdalene. Mary, the mother of James and Joseph. If you read the Gospels, you'll find these disambiguators always with the most common names and not with the less common names. Now, that's a rather striking thing. Now, I need to ask you to be a bit honest, though, tonight. Does any one of you struggle to remember names? Yeah? Okay, in business. You know what company the person works for. You know roughly how much they earn. You know all sorts of things about the deals they've done, but can you remember that vital piece of information at that key point, their name? No. Yeah, that's right. You can't remember the name because the name is essentially arbitrary. There's no logical reason for someone to have that name. There's often a logical reason for them not to have their name, but you should have told the parents that. So it's so difficult. Names are really hard to remember, and yet we find stories easy to remember. You watch a film, and you remember what the minor characters did. You forget their names. You might even forget the names of the major characters. You go on holiday. You come back and you tell your friends about these great people you met, but you don't even bother telling your friends their names because you know they're going to forget them. You say, I was with these great folk, and that's the way we do it. We have expressions like so-and-so when we don't even want to bother the person with the name. So one of the things we find out is that we forget names very easily because they are essentially so arbitrary. So some of you, after tonight, you're going to forget my name. I hope you remember the talk, but I don't mind you forget my name, and I'm going to forget some of your names. That's just the way it is, unless you're one of those really deliberate people that, creeps people out by remembering names. So think about this then. If the Gospels have correctly got the sort of detail that's one of the hardest details to remember, isn't there every reason to think they can get the other things right? Now, some people think that the Gospel stories arose by a process which, in all political incorrectness, is called Chinese whispers, okay? You know this, you sit around in maybe 10 of you in a circle, and you tell the story, you tell a message in whispers to each other. And some people say this is how Christianity arose, this is how messages can become corrupted. Now, let's remember, that game is set up deliberately to corrupt the message. So it's not a very good analogy for how Christianity began. You can only say the message once, you've got to whisper it, and you're only allowed to hear it from one person, and that ensures it gets corrupted. Okay? I would say karate is a better analogy for how Christianity spread. No one worries that karate is becoming corrupted because it's taught from one person to another, because you know there are lots of checks and balances in it. But if Christianity did arise through that Chinese whispers method, do you know what would happen? Very, very soon, the names of people in the stories would get missed out or corrupted or wrong. Yeah? Because actually, you only get that high-quality data if you get things really early on in transmission. Well, let's go on to some other things. I could give you a list of the 12 disciples in Matthew's Gospel. What I'm just going to show here is these are the ranks of these names in Palestine I put whenever it's in the top 99 names. But these statistics have only been known for the last 8 years. And what we find is whenever it's in the top 99 names, it's a popular one. Whenever it's, say, in the top 11, it's got a disambiguator. And whenever it's not, like Philip or Bartholomew or Thomas, not even in the top 99, or Thaddeus at 39th equal, there is no disambiguator. I can show you in the Gospels, when you get mentions of Jesus. Now, Jesus is a famous chap now, but back then he wasn't. Jesus was a common name. There were other Jesuses around. You find in the speech in the Gospels, in crowd settings, they don't just say Jesus is coming down the road. Because the question naturally would have been, which Jesus are we talking about? In speech in the Gospels, you can always see in a crowd setting, they identify Jesus with a disambiguator. That's exactly the way they would have had to have spoken back then, really early on for the first few decades, but not after that, because by then Jesus was very famous. You see, so you can go and check this out. Read the Gospels for yourselves. Here's a bit of speech we can find. John was a common name. And yet what we find here is when John is in is talked about by the characters in the narrative, they can't just say John, they have to say John something. They call him John the Baptist. But the narrator can simply say John because it's clear who he's talking about. But when Herodias' daughter says she wants the head of John the Baptist, she doesn't just say, give me the head of John, because she might have got the head of the wrong John. There were other Johns around. So she says, give me the head of John the Baptist, but the narrator continues, give me the head of John. He gave him the head of John. So in other words, you can look at the details of the Gospel narratives and find they're getting this right. I could compare that with some of the Gospels, so-called Gospels, people are trying to push through the media, apocryphal Gospels. They say, hey, what about this one? You know, those four you've got in the Bible aren't the best ones. What about some other ones? Well, I can tell you. I mean, look at the Gospel of Judas that was published in National Geographic a few Easters ago to make a big splash. And you think, how good are their sort of selection of names? Well, they've got two figures with the right sort of names for the time and place, Judas and Jesus, and then a whole load of folk from outer space. So it's not very impressive. So my conclusion is they've got the right pattern. And it's not the sort of pattern you would expect if you get a forger. That's not a proof of its truth. I want to come on to some other tests. Do they know the place they're writing about? Well, one of the things we can say is in the Gospels, they also know the names of little villages. Now, if I were making up a story about Jesus living in Rome, I guess I could go into a bookshop and buy a list of places, a description of geography by someone, but that would be a description of the, 10 places you need to visit before you die, and Palestinian villages were not on the list, you see? So how would I know if I were making up a story in another country that even such a little village as Bethphage exists? But that's the sort of detail you're getting all the time in the Gospels. I compare that with some of the apocryphal Gospels, just as a controlled experiment, and I chose my 16 earliest other Gospels and found they only had one correctly located town, which is Jerusalem. There is a Gospel of Philip that thinks that Jesus' middle name was Nazareth, which is a bit of a, no-no. So not very good in comparison with the four Gospels. So we've got plenty of examples of people making up stories and getting it wrong, and the four Gospels really do stand apart from that. Now, I promised you some numbers, and here, this is the top of page 2 of the sheet, you can see the raw statistics here. Based on an English Bible, I'm going to give you based on a Greek Bible, but I'll give you the English because I want you to be able to go home and check what I'm saying. So, very simply, get the electronic text of the Bible in English and work out how many place names there are. What we find is, here's the number of words there are in each Gospel. The four left-hand columns are the four Gospels we're talking about. The five right-hand columns are five other Gospels. Now, look at those four left-hand columns. I've just changed slide from the number of words to the number of places. Okay, there's the number of words. There's the number of places. What do you notice? That the four Gospels stay essentially static. If I go place names per 1,000 words, I get that. Rather remarkable fact that all four Gospels have this evenness of place names per 1,000 words, Well, how can I explain that? I don't think you can explain it by saying they copied from each other. It would have been difficult enough to count words back then because they didn't even divide between them in the manuscripts. The effort of calculating length and working out the same proportion of place names would just be phenomenal. But I think if they were putting in place names just to make the story sound authentic, some would put in too few, some would put in too many, you wouldn't get the same pattern. But if they're all recording the same sort of material, the same sort of accounts, putting in place names where they're relevant, yes, you could see why they'd get an evenness of spread. I want to give you another test. What about botany? Do they have the right plants? And things like that. Well, I don't know whether any of you know the story of Zacchaeus. Zacchaeus was a little man who apparently, according to the Sunday school song, climbed up a sycamore tree. Well, that's actually what it says in Luke's Gospel. Now, in Luke's Gospel, this story is set in Jericho. And guess what? Here is a sycamore tree in Jericho. Well, how does a writer know that there are sycamore trees in Jericho? Because at that time, as well as now, sycamore trees don't even grow in Turkey and Greece and Italy. Someone in those countries wouldn't even have known that such a tree existed. So, again, we can say something about the authors or their knowledge based on that sort of thing. We can look at it again. The feeding of the 5,000. Now, you might say, that's all very well. You're showing me these incidental things are correct. But what about miracles? The feeding of the 5,000 is one of those things that's accounted for in all four Gospels. But is it true? The idea is that Jesus feeds 5,000 men, plus women and children, with five loaves, breaking them up, and two fish. Well, doesn't that just sound like complete fantasy? What's interesting about the story is that you get little details. One of the Gospels says how the grass is green. Another says there's much grass. One of the Gospels tells you that at this time many people are coming and going, but he doesn't explain why. But another Gospel tells you it's Passover time. Well, that's an interesting thing, because if I put those two details together, one explains the other. Passover is the big Jewish festival when people needed to migrate or go on pilgrimage. So one detail fits with the other. Okay? That's the sort of subtle agreement we expect when things are true. When I was a lecturer up in Aberdeen University, it was my pleasure and privilege to prosecute plagiarism. And I would call people in at 9 a.m. usually, so they had a sleepless night the night before, and we would go through things, and very quickly you'd find out whether their story is true from just corroboration. Well, that's the sort of subtle agreement you can find between the four Gospels. But then, in John's Gospel, Jesus asked someone called Philip, one of his disciples, where to buy bread from. Why does he ask this particular disciple? But then, Philip and another disciple, Andrew, reply. Why? Luke's Gospel tells us the feeding took place near Bethsaida. None of the other Gospels tell us this. But John's Gospel tells us Philip and Andrew were actually from Bethsaida. Now, you see the subtle agreement there, again, in the details. If I read through that one Gospel, John's Gospel, I would see no significance to why Jesus is said to turn to one disciple and ask him some details. But if I plug in the information from Luke, suddenly it makes sense. Even the detail in John's Gospel that they were barley loaves fits exactly with Passover time when you just had the barley harvest. Now, I guess you guys are all thinking about the rain. So the question is, would the grass be green? Well, we need a precipitation chart, don't we? From a nearby town, and we then work out when Passover would be in any of these years, and we can say, would the grass have been green? Sure, you've had six of the greatest months of precipitation leading up to this point. So even that little detail fits exactly with what we know of the time and place. Now, you might say, well, that's all the incidental stuff. What about the miracle? Well, guess what? I can't prove the miracle. But what I can say is the idea that miracle stories arose through gradual exaggeration or through careless narration is problematic, because lack of care in one area spills over to other areas. So it's not really plausible that they get, you know, the little details right and people's names right, the right characters in the story, and get the really huge things wrong. Do you see? So one of the things I'd say is this data goes against what you would expect if the stories arose through gradual retelling from mouth to mouth. But could it all have been made up? Well, just a few considerations about this, and then I must end. Christians are too disorganized to pull it off. They suffer too much. They're too divided. They're too truthful. Not that that means that they can't lie, but there's a culture of truth, right? Just as in the city, you know, there's a culture of seeking to balance the books and so on. Okay? But fundamentally, the message that Christians have is simply too foolish. Two really key foolish elements of it. One is belief in the bodily resurrection of Jesus. Well, that's just bizarre, because back then, people thought that when you died, you went to some sort of ethereal existence. Coming back in bodily form was actually a bit disgusting and gross. Secondly, they believed that they should worship a man who had been crucified. Well, crucifixion was the way the Romans showed they were the winners. This is a bit of graffiti from Rome from the 2nd century. Show you another picture. What you've got, sorry, the Greek font didn't come out. A donkey's head on a cross, shown backwards so you see his buttocks, okay? And a man underneath raising his arm in prayer, and the graffiti says, Alexamenos worships God. That was how people viewed Christianity. Worshipping someone who had been crucified was like as stupid as worshipping a donkey, you see. So given the lack of organization, given the fundamentally stupid message that Christians had, that God was revealing himself and all of his glory by sending someone to die on a cross, how can he show that he's in charge when crosses are all about showing the Romans are in charge? You know, how did that get off the ground? Well, I'd say something like the resurrection would really explain it. If Jesus really did come back from the dead, that could start this sort of thing. Then that would show a real significance to his death, that his death was there for a purpose, actually as a sacrifice for our sins. That was the early Christian message. But how did that message get off the ground otherwise? Well, I've spoken for too long, and so it is over to you. Thank you for listening so patiently.